Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's program, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, with author Gary Camilla in conversation with Mark Hertzgard. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about our programs, membership, and traveling with the club, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our guests tonight, Gary Camilla and Mark Hertzgard. Gary Camilla was a co-founder and longtime executive editor of Salon, where he was the Middle East editor, covered three Olympics, and wrote about politics, current events, art, books, and music, as well as humor and personal essays. Before Salon, he was a culture critic and book editor at the San Francisco Examiner and senior editor at its Sunday magazine, Image. His work has appeared in the New York Times Book Review, Sports Illustrated, Art Forum, and many other publications. He was recently hired as the executive editor of San Francisco Magazine. His new book, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, is currently the number one nonfiction book on both the San Francisco Chronicle bestseller list and the Northern California Independent Bookstore's bestseller list. It was acclaimed by novelist and longtime San Franciscan Herb Gold as the city's defining lyrical panorama for a generation or longer, and praised by the New York Times as a grand pleasure. Mark Hertzgard is the author of six books that have been translated into 16 languages, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. As an independent journalist, he has reported from 25 countries about politics, culture, and climate change for outlets including The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Time, Mother Jones, and The Nation, where he is the environment correspondent. Hertzgard has also been a public radio commentator for Morning Edition, Living on Earth, and Marketplace. He lives in San Francisco with his daughter, Kiara, the inspiration for his book, Hot. Please join me in welcoming Gary Camilla and Mark Hertzgard.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Mark Hertzgard. That good-looking guy over there is Gary Camilla. And if you love San Francisco, you are in for a real treat tonight. Whether you live here in the city or in the surrounding Bay Area, or maybe you live halfway across the world, if San Francisco holds a special place in your heart and you want to know more about it, you have come to the right place. Because for the next hour, you will be listening to perhaps the single most knowledgeable, enthusiastic, and entertaining guide to the city that you could ever hope to find, Mr. Gary Camilla, the author of Cool Gray City of Love. If you pick up the front cover of this book, you will see a blurb from local author Dave Eggers, who puts the point quite concisely. He says, quote, "I can't imagine there's anyone who knows San Francisco better than Gary Camilla." And I can personally vouch for that because, full disclosure here, I've known Mr. Camilla quite well for more than 20 years now. And, in fact, it was his descriptions of California and specifically San Francisco that went a long way towards persuading me to move here from the East Coast the first time I lived here. He just made it seem like the greatest place on earth. But, there is a but. Don't worry, this is not going to be one of those suck up to the star interviews.
It isn't.
And besides, you see, because I'm Gary's friend, I know all the inside stories, all the dirty secrets.
I must be going.
Which we will get to very shortly. But first, let's start with something that kind of comes out of all the years that I spent living overseas. And as I was reading your book, it really came through to me very powerfully that San Francisco is one of those cities that is loved and almost idolized, not only by its inhabitants, but by people who live very far away from it. And I can only think of a few other cities like that in the world. Paris, New York, maybe New Orleans, maybe Rome, but not too many others. And so I wonder, from somebody who loves and knows San Francisco so well, what do you think accounts for San Francisco being on that very short list of cities that are beloved pretty much all over the world?
I think that it's a number of things. I think first and foremost, when you're talking about San Francisco, you always have to talk about its terrain and its physical beauty. It's stunning terrain. It's extraordinary physical beauty. I've traveled very extensively many of the great cities of the world that are renowned for their physical beauty. The only one that I would say that is just straight out, flat out, more spectacular in its setting than San Francisco is Rio de Janeiro. And when I was in Rio, I got robbed 5 times. So there's some downside to Rio, although it is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, imagine, you know, the Land's End walk in San Francisco, just writ large on every corner, that's Rio. So San Francisco's physical setting is remarkable, and everyone who visits it realizes that. There's very few places in the world that are like this. It's at the only gap in the Coast Range, which is 600 miles long, the Golden Gate, this incredible, one of the most dramatic places on Earth. And it's a city that is built on innumerable hills. The number is a matter of theological disputation, but there's hills on every corner. So, you know, that is, and the incredible bay, one of the great estuaries in the world. So that's part of it, but that's not the only reason. I think that San Francisco also has, in the minds of all of those who have been here or who just know about it, is associated with a kind of freedom and a kind of end of the continent, devil-may-care quality, a quality of maverickness, of independence, of free thinking, the cataclysmic birth in the gold rush, the earthquake, its long tradition of dissent, of artistic ferment and free thinking. And Europeans in particular who come to San Francisco always, this is an infamous, famous thing that all Europeans come and they go, this is the only American city that feels like Europe, and which is a compliment in many ways for an urbanist. I mean, the great cities in Europe have walkability, neighborhoods, and sort of a terroir, to use the French term for terrain with wine, that American cities generally don't have. And San Francisco, you mentioned New Orleans, which also has that. And, of course, New York City has it in its own special way. I would put that in the category as well. And there's many great American cities. But San Francisco does have that quality of it's like a collection of villages. It's got an extraordinary sense of change as you move through it. It's a pedestrian city, a walker city. And that great tradition of freedom and experimentation and ferment. So, and people, I think almost, in a certain way, it embodies almost what people think of California, it's the end of it's the last frontier town. And even now, I think there's a sense that people look at San Francisco like it's still on the frontier in some ways. And so I think there's a romance to it that I think is imperishable and perhaps not always deserved, but we'll dine out on it as long as we can.
Now, right? One of the other most quoted remarks, you mentioned tourists, which are obviously a big part of the economy here. One of the most quoted remarks you hear from tourists and even from locals about San Francisco, of course, is credited to Mark Twain, that the coldest winter I ever spent was summer in San Francisco. Well, one of the many things that I learned in reading this book is that Twain actually never said that. So who did say it? How did it get wrongly attributed to Mark Twain? And then how did it enter into the folklore of San Francisco?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that there was no record of Twain having said it. Somebody decided that it sounded like Twain. Twain did actually have many wonderfully entertaining and quite caustic things to say about San Francisco's weather. He wrote one piece in which he takes a 6 a.m. horse ride out to the Cliff House, which he describes as a medieval torture and in his inimitable way. And this is, he's a young reporter writing this, and he's talking about, you know, looking out, you know, out towards the ocean, and he says, and there are icebergs out there. so he was not a fan of the freezing San Francisco weather at times, but he never said that. So it's just one of those, it's an urban legend, if you will, that I don't know what its provenance is.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever trace how it kind of got to be so famous? Because it's like Rice-A-Roni and the Golden Gate Bridge. That's about how famous it is.
There's sufficient truth in it that it obviously, especially if you lived west of Twin Peaks, that it resonated with people, and they kept saying it.
Well, now, another famous line about San Francisco comes from a close friend of yours, I know, the former Republican Congressman Newt Gingrich.
Yes. Very close friend.
Who famously derided, quote, San Francisco values, unquote. So if you had 1 hour with Mr. Gingrich to get him to rethink his disdain for San Francisco values, where in the city would you take him and why?
That's an interesting question. I'd probably take him to somewhere like, you know, deep in the heart of the old North Beach, Barbary Coast area, where there are still the Jackson Square Historic District, where the Gold Rush buildings, some of them still exist, and point out, gee, Mr. Gingrich, this is the most capitalistic city in the history of America. This was when the Gold Rush happened, Thoreau denounced the Gold Rush as a monstrous display of greed, which it was. It was like the greatest greed explosion in American, maybe in world history. And, hey, this is free enterprise, dude. Like, you know, this is San Francisco. And also, excuse me, but, like, you know, I wonder if he's noticed the great entrepreneurial generation of wealth that's coming out of San Francisco right now. That's San Francisco values, too. So in terms of his own extreme allegiance to Adam Smith capitalism, I would say that San Francisco would stand up quite well, far better than the cities in his own state, which probably have a much greater need for federal handouts than San Francisco does. In terms of the cultural ramifications that he's speaking of, I fear that even an hour, even a year, even a lifetime with Mr. Gingrich would not suffice. Maybe I could take him to the Folsom Street Fair and, you know, blow his mind.
We might have a heart attack on our hands. So.
We might find out things about Newt that perhaps we don't know. You know, we know that he does have a liking for the flesh.
I want to give our audience a taste here of the quality of the prose in this book. So I'd like to read a passage and then follow up with a question. And for those of you who might be following along, this comes from the bottom of page 72. For cities are museums of time, and to live in them is to be haunted by the places they once were. The waterways that existed before the skyscrapers and freeways are a vanished world that beckons to us. When we catch glimpses of them, the city disappears. Its two known streets dissolve into unfathomable terrain. It becomes innocent again. We want to unmake the city, to regain a lost paradise. And perhaps we are also driven to unmake ourselves, to return to an earlier time in our own lives, one not yet marked off with streets and signs, to become again the children we once were, playing with a hose in the backyard, back when happiness was easy and water was everywhere. Beautiful stuff. So if you could take the audience back in time to this peninsula as it existed before industrial civilization arrived here, what spot in San Francisco would you bring us to? maybe Mission Creek?
Yeah, I think Mission Creek is a good call because of all of the great changes that have taken place in San Francisco's terrain. That was by far the most dramatic. Mission Bay, everyone knows now, enters by the two historic counterweighted bridges that are just off of the new ballpark, the wonderful new ballpark, and it then extends for maybe 600 or 800 yards to the west, where there's a wonderful motley collection of houseboats that are grandfathered in there on Channel Street. And it then dead ends abruptly at 7th Street, a very interesting street that has a very futurist kind of look with the freeways over it. And that mighty entrance, that tidal entrance of the bay, just ends there now. But if you go back to before industrialization, before the white man came, that creek extended almost all the way to Mission Dolores and was navigable by flat-bottom boat all that far. There's some wonderful old maps. I think the place of everything I've ever seen, it was one very detailed map that I saw, that there was a little inlet of the end of that waterway, and it was marked footbridge, and it crossed at 19th and Treat in the Mission. And I would dearly love to be able to stand on that footbridge, you know, and that's after, you know, that this is in 1850 or something when this map was made. But before that, it was a huge marsh and, several hundred acres of squishy, muddy waterways filled with waterfowl. And extending all of south of Market was covered with this, which is one of the reasons, one of the great tragic ironies of the earthquake was that you can trace the devastation and the bloodshed, the tragedy of the earthquake unerringly follows the lines of the old waterways that we covered up. It's almost like the earth was taking its revenge for being profaned, because the San Franciscans, as soon as they came to San Francisco, there was this mania, like, we must cover up this water, and which, you know, by their lights made sense. The city had very limited land, and especially south of Market, they immediately began to fill it. But all of that was what was called made land at the time. Obviously, it was extremely unstable, and it liquefied. They did studies after the earthquake studying it, and the buildings on that liquefied land collapsed, so that the worst bloodshed in San Francisco, I wrote about this in a Chronicle column a few weeks ago, was at the corner on 6th, between Folsom and Howard. And a whole row of boarding houses simply collapsed, one against the other, like a domino effect, killing hundreds of unknown numbers of people. And that was all because that was stood on an old lake had been there, but this was all part of the same marshy water system. So long-winded answer to your question, but Mission Bay and Mission Creek were the most majestic and utterly changed part of the terrain. Other than that, in many ways, some aspects of it were harsh and forbidding, beautiful in their own way, but for those that came, for the people that came even before the 49ers, it was a wilderness of sand dunes with no trees, almost no trees, only scrub brush. You know, this marshy land south of Market, but it was very difficult even to walk. Early reports of people trying to walk from what is now Union Square to North Beach would take hours, because you're walking through over 80-foot high sand dunes and incessant westerly wind, no buildings, no trees to stabilize anything, just a wind blowing in your face. And when they created Golden Gate Park, Before they created it, horses had difficulty facing west. The wind blew into their faces so hard. So it was not an easy place to live, and many people really detested it.
This reminds me of the passage in your book where you talk about part of the time when you were writing this, you were living over in Berkeley, and you would look across to San Francisco and have this, as you put it, Copernican shift in your view of San Francisco because you came to realize why the Native Americans actually thought, you know, we're going to stay here on the East Bay side,
They were
it's
dumb.
Nice and warm, and it's there's that promontory out there, and it's cold and foggy and windy and all that.
So, no, it's really true. I mean, if you're in the East Bay.
And you were born in the East Bay, but you came over here, right?
That's right, and I always smugly considered, you know, this is the center of the world, San Francisco. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't until that time when I spent some time in the East Bay looking out at it, and I thought it sort of almost reminded me of like an atoll, you know, like one of those reefs. And it's like this is just this meaningless piece of land out there that doesn't go anywhere and that's really cold. And you know, I still love it, but it's an outlier that adds to its drama.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, presenting a conversation with Gary Camilla, author of Cool Gray City of Love. I'm Mark Hertzgard. You know, you mention in the book, but it doesn't get a lot of emphasis, that before your career in journalism, you spent 7 years as a taxi driver here in San Francisco. If you had not had that experience, how would this book have been different? Or would you have even been able to write this book at all?
I could have written it, no doubt, because I always explored San Francisco very assiduously from the beginning before I was a taxi driver. But certainly a lot of the raunchier tales in the book, some of which are in the chapter about the Tenderloin, would not have existed because taxi driving, as I say in the book, sin and taxi driving go together like gin and tonic. And so a lot of those lubricious stories would not have appeared. And also, probably I wouldn't have had as great a knowledge of the way all of the obscure quarters of the city hold together. Mm. And I don't pretend that I still have that knowledge the way I did when I was a taxi driver. When you're a taxi driver, it's literally like you have to know how to get from anywhere to anywhere. So that if you're in the Ingleside and you have to go into the Bayview, or you have to, you know, if you have to go from somewhere in Twin Peaks to go out into a certain place in, you know, south of Market, you have to know all of the most direct routes and know how it all stitches together. So that there, I think, that in some sense, it probably, at some unconscious level, created a city that was, you know, even more rich and interconnected. Being a taxi driver is a unique sense. It gives one a unique sense of a city. You sometimes feel that you've got a finger on the pulse of the place. Don't ask where that finger might be, but in a way that no other job does, because you are just moving through the city constantly, and it's kind of a roulette game also. I mean, every ride is different, and yeah, a lot of them are formulaic, but then you get all kinds of strange, you know, odd things that happen when you're driving a taxi, and the So I treasure that experience in terms of the what it brought to the book. I still would have done the book, I think, but I wouldn't have been exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the inside stories about Gary Camilla. Gary is one of those people that whenever you're wondering, okay, where should we go to have a drink, you cannot find a better source of information. He knows the bars in every part of the city. So I thought that one thing that would be interesting is to tell people what are three or four bars in San Francisco that are classic San Francisco bars but probably not known so well. Mm-hmm. That if you were to do a chauffeured pub crawl, as it were, but you had somebody who was going to drive you around the course of a period of time to four separate bars. Mm. What would those bars?
Ah, that's an interesting question. Well, I think I'd have to start out with one of my personal favorites that I don't know if anyone here has ever been to. It's literally In fact, it's not in San Francisco, but it's only 300 yards over the lawn. And that is the 7 Mile House, which is off the old bay shore, just a few hundred yards south of the city line. And these Mile houses are very, very old. They go back to the mid-19th century, where they were used as horse-changing places, post offices and often whorehouses. And, you know, they had a variety of uses. But the 7 Mile House is a just has a wonderful old atmosphere. They have great jazz there on Tuesday night, nothing but Horace Silver tunes. It's wonderful, run by a great Filipino family. And that's a really fun place.
Okay, so that's called again?
It's called the 7 Mile House.
Okay, 7 Mile House. There's our first stop. And then yeah. Where would you go next?
Well, and this is there's no geographical order to this, but I think
you're not driving.
I would suggest that everyone should pop in at some point, perhaps in the daytime, to the 21 Club at the corner of Turk and Taylor, which is the raunchiest corner in San Francisco. It is the end of the raunchiest block in San Francisco. I just interviewed the police captain of the Tenderloin, and I didn't realize there's this wonderful word that applies to the first block, the 0 to 100 block. That's called the uniblock. So this is in the end of the uniblock of Turk. The uniblock of Turk is the worst block in San Francisco, without doubt. It's the one between Mason and Taylor. But on the corner of Taylor is a wonderful little tiny bar called the 21 Club, a wonderful bartender named Frankie, very delightfully friendly clientele. It has a very homey quality in there. Only occasional madmen and criminals that pop in. It's generally quite, it's a really... It has a great feeling of camaraderie. And actually, Esquire, just so you know that I'm not completely making this up, actually named it one of the best bars in the country.
Hmm.
So that's a really, really interesting bar, great bar. Then I'd have to throw in the strange Trader Sam's out on Geary.
Is that spelled T-R-A-D?
T-R-A-D apostrophe R, like Trader Vic's, but it's a very debased version of Trader Vic's. But it has a tiki motif with the little, the little seats have, I think they're called like, New Guinea or, Bongo Bongo or whatever they call some sort of ersatz, Polynesian themes. And I haven't been in there for a number of years, but they used to have these wonderful little display cases on the wall, which would feature like little pint bottles of booze in the display cases, which I thought was like, mystifying and strange. But that's pretty old. I don't know how old the Trader Sam's is, but it probably goes back to the 30s, I'm guessing. So,
and then what would bat cleanup?
Batting cleanup, well, everybody probably knows this bar, but it's pretty hot. You can't list bars in San Francisco without having one in North Beach. And I think, Specs is closed right now, so we'll take that, we'll hold that. But Vesuvio is really an immortal San Francisco bar. It has some serious historical chops because this is where Neil Cassidy and Jack Kerouac and I believe Ferlinghetti all gathered for a little horn before they and Ginsberg before they drove off to the apocryphal reading at the Six Gallery of Howell. So it's got some good historical legs. And it's a wonderful bar. It has an great upstairs with this kind of, mezzanine. You can look down from above, and you can look out and see, I don't know if the nipples are still flashing at the old Carol Dota's, but it has a wonderful view of Broadway and Columbus. And it's, North Beach is obviously not what it once was, but there's still some good ghosts in that bar, and I've probably had more drinks in that place than anywhere else, so I'm choosing that one.
Okay, there we have it. The 7 Mile House, the 21 Club, Trader Sam's, and Vesuvio, for those of you who are writing this down. And now on to a little bit more of a serious question about San Francisco. In the portion of the book where you're writing about Mission Creek, you observe that, quote, the pitiless laser beam of money, unquote, found Mission Creek and in essence destroyed it. The pitiless laser beam of money. Love that phrase. And nowadays, as the second dot-com boom is wafting through San Francisco, it seems that that pitiless laser beam of money has all of the city in its sights. And this is obviously a long discussion we've talked about this a lot in San Francisco over many years with the first dot-com boom and many booms before that. But where do you come down on this whole question? Do you think that San Francisco is now in danger of becoming a haven only for the affluent? And if so, what do you think it will take for the working class and the middle class, not to mention the poor, to be able to stay in San Francisco in the years ahead?
Well, that's the $64 question. And I probably don't have any more of a definitive answer to that than anybody else does. I do think the city is in danger of becoming increasingly dominated by great wealth, which is pouring in. And when I say danger, I don't think that great wealth coming into a city is entirely bad or has entirely negative consequences. Cities evolve. I mean, one thing that I learned in part from doing this book is to take a really long historical perspective and to realize that you can protest and you can wring your hands and you can, you know, lament the old days, but, well, first of all, San Franciscans have been doing that virtually since the gold rush. So the good old days were, for the 49ers, were the halcyon days when it was, you know, a handful of adventurers and Californios. And then even by the 1880s, the gold rush days were looking wonderful and, you know, primeval and exciting, and now it's getting too respectable. This goes on and on and on. However, having said that, it is true that even more than the first dot-com boom, which I lived through as one of the founders of Salon and hoped to profit by, and, you know, maybe I did in some small way, but mostly I had to pay alternative minimum tax and the tulip mania number one. I think this tech boom actually has more legs than the first boom, and there's more money, and it's not just tech either. I just think the world has discovered San Francisco, so that in a certain way, all the things I'm talking about in this book or that helped to entice you to come here about how wonderful it is here, well, people have discovered that. It's not a secret anymore that this is one of the greatest places to live on planet Earth. And we don't have a society or a world in which you can draw the moats up around places like that. So there's incredible financial pressure to come in here. The tech thing is obviously huge as well right now. So I think that the biggest issue is not probably the very poor, who are quite well protected in San Francisco. And, you know, they have powerful defenders, and their enclaves in the Tenderloin are very well protected by nonprofits and by the city. The biggest danger and the real thing that's been an ongoing crisis in San Francisco for many years is the plight of the middle class and sort of the working, especially the, you know, these gradations are important. It's like the working to lower middle class. It's the teachers and the cops and the doc, and then not the doctors, the teachers, the cops, the just people that do work that maybe pays $40,000, $60,000 a year. It doesn't pay $100,000 a year. And those people are unable increasingly to live in San Francisco. And they also have difficulty with schooling. And it's just a lot of people have left town. A lot of people go to Oakland, go to various parts of the Bay Area. And no city, it's not healthy for any city to be, you know, hollowed out between a protected lower, very lower class, and a new class of very wealthy, often quite young people. And as I say, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a certain amount of that coming in, but it can become really disproportionate. So obviously, we have this Rube Goldberg system of rent control, which is effective in a very unfair way. And I support it, even though I've, you know, myself been harmed by it in many ways. I think that it could be tweaked, it could be adjusted. I don't know exactly how. I'm not an expert on that. It's a very inflexible system, but it does protect people who have, you know, who are grandfathered in. It doesn't do anything when places become vacant, of course. I don't know that there's ever going to be any way to do anything about that. I think it would probably require a national change in our entire housing policy. It would be something, it would have to almost be a socialistic imposition of rent prices it would be challenged as being unconstitutional. I think it's unthinkable. So I don't think we're ever going to have vacancy control.
Of the mathematics of it, as you mentioned, there's now a sort of a global elite class who, like you say, they've discovered San Francisco and similarly to New York City and Paris, and there's enough money on the part of those relatively small number of individuals to buy up the housing stock here. You mentioned in the book that there's now right across the street from your house that over the last year or two that's, been flipped over and bought for, I think it was, 2.5 million or whatever, and you have only once seen the owners.
Right.
So they are obviously absentee owners who want to have a place in San Francisco, but they're so rich that they don't even have to be here more than once or twice a year. So in that context, rent control is going to protect the people who are already here.
Right.
But as vacancies open and properties open, how do you keep that kind of money from just making it impossible for San Francisco to be anything more than just kind of a playground for the international rich?
Yeah, I think this is where you get into city housing policies and you get into affordable housing. I think the city needs to move not only to protect the very poor, but they need to start having subsidies and financial assistance precisely for the teachers, cops, bus drivers that are being forced out. So I think that that's an area where we need a Marshall Plan for the lower middle class in San Francisco. And I don't know how that would play out. I'm not an expert. I'm not a policy wonk about this stuff. But to me, that's like the number one thing the city is facing. And it's always going to be, what's important to remember is it's never going to be perfect. It's going to be really messy and it's going to be unfair because we still essentially live in a free market economy with incredible financial pressure from all around the world to come in here. So only a certain amount of housing is going to be able to be protected for that group of people. But I think it's important to have some of that.
Is there anything, you mentioned you learned a lot about San Francisco by taking the long view already in the book. Is there anything that you learned from the history of San Francisco that sheds any light on this?
Well, in a sense...
Because we've had booms before.
Yes, we've had booms before. I think, though, that I tend to be somebody that doesn't... I don't see a bust, actually, here. But short of a catastrophic global economic meltdown, in which case everybody descends into chaos and squalor, the fact is going to remain that this will be one of the most desirable places to live in the world. And that we now live in a global village of instant communication. It's not a secret anymore. Everybody knows about the climate, everybody knows about the terrain, everybody knows about the charming houses, about the technologically savvy workforce, and a lot of people want to come here. And I don't see that changing. And so in that regard, I actually think we're all in for a roller coaster of more and more wealth, and how we deal with it is going to be very, very problematic and very tricky. But, you know, it's something we've got to figure out.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, presenting a conversation with Gary Kamiya, author of Cool Gray City of Love. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Speaking of terrain, here's a question from someone in the audience who says, how do you think the terrain of San Francisco has influenced the free thinking of San Francisco?
Very interesting question. I don't think there's any way to absolutely quantify something like that, but many writers have talked about the sort of moment-to-moment, step-by-step shifts in perspectives that this city affords. And that, you know, you can see things that you've never seen before as you move through your daily routine. I was talking to a good friend of mine who lives in Atlanta, and she was going, God, it's just, you know, she lived in San Francisco for many years, and she was saying, there are no surprises. Everything's flat, and you don't look up and see some hill. You're not even sure what it is. And one of the chapters in this book, I talk about how San Francisco is a city of mystery hills, that no matter how many times you've walked it and no matter how many times you've looked at it, you'll come around some corner and go, what is that hill exactly? Is that like Silver Terrace, or is that Bayview? Is that Hunter's Point? And you you almost feel like it's those famous Crazy Cat cartoons in which the background, George Harriman's incredible genius cartoons, he would draw Crazy Cat in the foreground, and in each background would be a completely different mountain that would appear. And San Francisco feels like that. So I feel like that must do something to one's creative spirit, having that constant shuffling of your mental deck, as it were. And I think all San Franciscans know it. And it's part of the euphoria of walking the streets in this city. I mean, and it's virtually every neighborhood. You know, there's little pieces of the Golden Gate Bridge you see from Hunter's Point. And you can see things where no human being has ever set foot. You can see things, you know, from a roof in Nob Hill. You can see the base of hills in the Marin Headlands that are inaccessible. There's vertical cliffs. It's like you're living simultaneously in Chinatown and in the High Sierra. And that's that kind of extreme juxtaposition, I think, it kind of, you know, blows your mind out in a certain way. It's a powerful inducement to creative thinking. So I think that there's some connection there, but, you know, one could never say exactly what it is. But I think it's powerful.
Here's another question that a number of people in the audience tonight are asking variations of. How do we get non-locals to stop calling us Frisco and San Fran?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is a pet peeve that goes back to Herb Cain and even before. Although I believe that some scholar has determined that Frisco actually is a completely honorable and long-standing usage. Now, it may not sound like it when some rube starts talking, yeah, I went to Frisco, but if I remember I think it was an academic of some kind who wrote this article, Frisco goes back to, like, the nautical, you know, it's like an old sailor reference to San Francisco that goes back to the 19th century. So we've got to rehabilitate Frisco. As for San Fran, nothing good can be said about that usage. It's extremely disrespectful to the great saint this city was named for, and who our new pope, our admirable new pope, has chosen that name. So San Fran should be retired. There probably is no way to prevent people from using these expressions. So you simply have to put cotton in your ears and talk loudly to yourself.
You know, in your book, there are buckets and buckets of history, most of which I know that I didn't know, and I suspect a lot of people will have that same reaction when they read the book, which a lot of people are doing. I can tell you just today I was on Haight Street and went into Booksmith to buy another book. But I asked how Cool Gray City of Love was doing for them, and they said, oh, it's flying off the shelves. People kind of come in and they ask for that gray book. No, the one about San Francisco. So
I'm glad I chose the color gray.
Yeah.
That's good.
Maybe that explains why it's number one right now. But in terms of the history, I found one of the most fascinating passages concerns Hunters Point, which is a neighborhood that, let's be honest, is often ignored in contemporary media accounts, and certainly tourists don't visit Hunters Point, or it is feared as a hopelessly crime-ridden and economically depressed place. And you write about how the history of Hunters Point really tells quite a different story, and it's a story that is intertwined with race, which is a theme that comes up again and again and again in your book, how different racial groups have been really treated very, very badly here over the years, and some have come through that and some have come through it not so well. But talk a little bit about Hunters Point. And, you know, now we think of it as this black neighborhood, the one place in the city that actually has a lot of black people. But you say it wasn't always like that.
No, it's has a remarkable history. To begin with, it was probably the greatest concentration of the Yalamu, the native peoples who lived here for thousands of years. Again, like the East Bay, it's warm. It was relatively warm by San Francisco standards. It had streams. Isthmus Creek ran down there. It had good access to the bay. You could actually navigate the bay across to the East Bay from there. So it has a very, there are many of the archaeological sites in San Francisco are found down by Hunters Point in Visitation Valley. But then it became, as soon as the city got to be industrialized, immediately all of the unattractive industries began to be located there. So it immediately became a dumping ground. It was butcher town. All the early city ordinance required that all of the butcheries, slaughterhouses, be located in Hunters Point. There were cattle there. In fact, there's a wonderful image that some of the descendants of the early Mexican-American Californios, who were known as the finest horsemen on earth. These were like just superb riders. And they would be riding, you know, as cowboys through the streets of Hunters Point as late as, I think, the 1920s or 30s. The other great scandal, and of course, talking about race and the dispossession and, in fact, just the destruction of many groups, there are no innocents in this story except the native peoples who, you know, themselves were obviously not, you know, perfect. They're human beings, but they were wiped out, not necessarily by design, by the mission system and by the Spanish and then the Mexicans. By the time the Americans came on the scene, they were almost all gone. And then the other great tragedy of Hunters Point, or the strange story of Hunters Point, was after the 1906 earthquake, the city fathers, which had been looking at Chinatown with outrage and horror from the beginning of Chinatown and trying to get rid of it, and had been agitating to get rid of it, when the 1906 earthquake and fire completely destroyed Chinatown along with almost all of downtown San Francisco, guess where they wanted to put Chinatown? In Hunters Point. And they just simply wanted to pack it up and move it down there, and they appointed an august city commission to meet with the mayor, and all of the poobahs of San Francisco got together, all the white men in their suits got together and discussed how they're going to move Chinatown, and it completely failed. The Chinese had realized they had more political muscle, and they weren't going for it. They had their legal rights. And the courts would not stand for it. It was a completely outrageous, unprecedented attempt to simply dispossess a whole group and send them somewhere else. They met for like 20 times, and finally the leader says, it's not going to work. So Chinatown was not moved to Hunters Point. Then the final saga of the story is World War II, which brings African Americans into San Francisco essentially for the first time. There was a tiny 5,000-6,000 black people living in San Francisco before World War II broke out, and many of whom went back to very early pioneer days. When World War II happened, the federal government needed to keep its shipyards running 24/7, Marin Ship and Marin, the Kaiser Shipyards in Richmond, Hunters Point Shipyard, and they brought in thousands of mostly poor black people, mostly from Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma, South Arkansas, and they ended up seizing by eminent domain a lot of land in Hunters Point, building housing where many of these black workers were housed. And then after World War II, with the failure of society as a whole, San Francisco in particular, but it was not special to San Francisco, to provide new jobs. So the shipyards jobs ended. So you have this cataclysmic effect on a black population that comes from poverty and suddenly gets middle class jobs. And then kaboom, 1945, 1946, gone. And there was never a Marshall Plan. There was never San Francisco has always had a complicated racial history towards black people, not entirely, you know, not all bad, and in some ways more enlightened than many other parts of the country, but certainly not by flawed. And there were racial covenants.
Well, and if the economic bottom falls out, what are you going
to? Yeah, and but there was no proactive attempt to reach out or to do anything, and Hunters Point and Bayview fell into an economic decline from which they never recovered.
Well, and you mentioned in the book that there was actually a real, outright firefight in 1966 with the riots and probably the worst fighting ever here in San Francisco between citizens and police.
Yes, yeah, the hopelessness, rage was building. Of course, this is the time of the Watts riots, the Detroit riots, the Newark riots. There's a lot of black anger, black militants were on the rise across the country. And James Baldwin made this amazingly radical documentary about it called Take This Hammer, I think in 61, and this is 5 years later than that. But a cop shot a black teenager running from a stolen car on Navy Road in Hunters Point. I think the kid died in a ditch, and the place blew up. And there was rioting in Hunters Point, and there was rioting in the Western Addition, and it was an all-out firefight. And it's a miracle that it didn't turn out to be like Detroit, where many people were killed. I mean, this could have been a real bloodbath. And amazingly, nobody was actually killed. But, you know, you had young black men firing from the heights down at National Guardsmen down on 3rd Street trying to advance up the hill on Hunters Point. And, you know, that was an incredibly real wake-up call for the city. And, you know, they've started trying to throw money at the problem ever since with, you know, very, very unsatisfying results.
Mm-hmm. Anyone who reads this book will recognize that you are an unabashed lover of San Francisco, but yet you are not blind to the foibles of this place. And so another hypothetical question here. If there were one thing about this city that you could change, you know, one shortcoming that you could somehow correct, what would that be?
You know, I think the high-rise mania of the Feinstein years and afterwards is one of the great sins of San Francisco. The fact that there was just this Manhattanization, wholesale Manhattanization. If anyone has seen photographs of San Francisco taken in the 1940s versus photographs taken in the 1980s, it's in the 1940s from the bay you can see all of the hills and you can see the terrain of the city. By the 1980s you have, sadly, a lot of the architecture is undistinguished. A lot of it doesn't look that different from Houston. There are some beautiful modern buildings, no doubt. But I think that was extreme. It's unfortunate to me that wasn't controlled more at the time. Of course, there's no way that you're not going to have a high-rise development because it brings corporations and big tax money into the city's financial base. And if you don't have it, you stagnate economically. But it was pretty out of control. So, you know, that's something that has always bugged me. And, you know, I've witnessed it in my own lifetime to a degree. And then, you know, what we were talking about before, just a lot of the waterways, you know, the fact that every stream in the city got covered up. This is, you know, an impossible rewriting of history because no pioneer people let swamps go. So their first thing to get covered up is swamps because they're unhealthy and they aren't efficient. But now the city spends millions of dollars trying to daylight, you know, Tennessee Creek and the Presidio, one little tiny stretch of water, and there are places like that all over town. So that's something. In terms of a broader cultural sort of political ramifications, I think that the city was far more conservative than people recognize that it was before the 1960s. My good friend and colleague David Talbot wrote a wonderful book about this called Season of the Witch, where he really explains that the San Francisco of the 1960s and 70s had to be fought for and won. We had a very deeply conservative Irish Catholic hierarchy and establishment that was, not amenable to a lot of the social changes that were coming into the city, and there was a pretty big collision there. So you don't want to mythologize the city's past, but it came through it.
Mm-hmm. Couple more questions from the crowd here. One gets back to topography, and it says that the topography that you're talking about, it exists around the Bay Area,
right.
and mentions in particular the Ridge Trail that goes all the way around San Francisco
right.
Bay, and they want to know, have you hiked that trail, and can you talk a little bit about the surroundings of San Francisco as adding to its appeal.
Right. First of all, I have not hiked the entire Ridge Trail. I'd love to, actually, because it's just one of those things. You see it, and it's, I guess there's still quite a few gaps in it, I believe, but it's enormous. And it has just magnificent places throughout the whole Bay Area. But, yeah, from San Francisco, you can look out. At any given point, and you can see Mount Diablo to the east, from which, you know, is one of the longest views of anywhere in the world from the top of Mount Diablo. If you look up to the north, there's some mountain. I've never been able to quite figure out what it is, but it's in the Mayacamas in Napa. That's way up there. You know, you can see, Big Rock, a mountain up by Lucas Valley Road is visible to the north. There's all of these and many, many more that I don't even know the names of. So that sense of the surrounding topography is what I was saying about the city itself. The Bay Area is incredibly rich and incredibly stimulating to know that you can hike. If you tried to walk to the top of every peak you can see from San Francisco, you could spend your whole life doing it. You can spend a whole life exploring Mount Tam. You know, that's one mountain. And, you know, it's the biggest of the immediate ones in our area, but there are many other ones. And it's an incredible. And the other thing that has to be pointed out is the foresight and, again, the political struggle and to turn so much of the Bay Area into public space and into green spaces and into parks. This is one of the things that we should all be very proud of as Bay Areans. We fought the forces of development, and in many, many cases we won. And there's the Bay itself was won. Was saved
right,
in,
you
large,
have that story
in large
in the book,
part
yeah.
because of three faculty wives at UC Berkeley. Along with, you know, some other, far-sighted individuals who realized that the Bay, back in as late as the early 1960s, there were only, like, I don't remember the number exactly, but there were something like 20 or maybe 5 miles of the shoreline that were open to the public. All of the rest of it was privately owned. It was like, no, that's, you know, some company owns that. It was fenced off. And so that's one of the great environmental victories in the whole country. And in fact, I think it's safe to say that in some ways it was an inspiration for the whole green movement in the United States, was the Saving the Bay movement. So these are all remarkable achievements.
Well, and you know how the Bay Area is the de facto headquarters for the U.S. environmental movement, really.
Right. Yeah.
And it still has that today. A little bit related question to that is from a bicycling enthusiast here. So, and you yourself are a bicycling enthusiast. We go biking together a lot. They want to know, do you identify the streets in the book that are bike-friendly here in San Francisco?
I have a brief passing reference to a well-known and beloved route known as the Wiggle, which any bicyclist knows is this wonderful way that you can get from around Church and Market up to Golden Gate Park and up through the plateau that's there, and you have to climb up that hill, which if you don't know about it and you say, oh, I'll just go up Haight Street, for example, it's not fun. But the Wiggle, you know, just follows, there's some mnemonic thing, you know, and it's kind of like whenever you have a choice, always turn. I can't even remember what it is, and I don't live near there, so I don't take the Wiggle that often.
But topographically, what does the Wiggle follow? Isn't that an old route?
The wonderful thing about the Wiggle is the Wiggle follows what was called the Old Spanish Trail,
right,
which led from the Mission to the Presidio. And, of course, it made sense. So one of the things that's delightful about San Francisco is that whenever you're finding, and a bike is the way that you're going to find this out the most, whenever you're looking for the least steep hill, you're going to be following in the footsteps not only of the 49ers and of the Californios and of the Spanish, but even of the Indians. Because from time immemorial, nobody wants to climb a steep hill. So my house on Jackson and Hyde, you could go up that by going up Pacific. That's the Pacific is the least steep way into Knob Hill, and that was called the Puerto Zuela, the low pass, by the Californios. And so, you know, that little market at the top of that hill has seen, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of people going over that pass. So that's a neat thing when you're bicycling, to sort of know you're rolling in the footsteps of a lot of people.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest is Gary Camilla, author of Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco. I'm Mark Hertzgard. We are in our last moments here. So I'm just going to give you one quick question I think you can answer pretty quickly, which is, and I didn't see this in the book, who would you consider the greatest mayor in the history of San Francisco, and how do the last few mayors, Ed Lee, the current mayor, and the other recent mayors, measure up against the greatest mayor in San Francisco history, and you have about 90 seconds to give us your answer.
Oh, boy. This is an area of the city that I have about the least expertise in, is comparative mayoral abilities.
But you've never been shy from offering your opinions in the past.
You know, I mean, I think that, Moscone was in many ways a very admirable mayor, did a lot of great things for the city. I think Mayor Alioto actually was a very, very strong mayor. And if you go back all the way to the sort of City Beautiful movement of Phelan, Mayor Phelan was he had a great weak spot.
What year was he?
This is earthquake days, and you know he was the one that argued for the City Beautiful movement that created the Civic Center. He did have a serious Achilles heel, which was he was virulently anti-Oriental, as they used to say, anti-Chinese, anti-Japanese. But he was a very progressive mayor and was a breath of fresh air. I would put those guys up there.
And Ed Lee?
Ed Lieb, you know, it's...
First Chinese mayor.
Yes, first. It's great that we have our first Chinese-American mayor, and I think he's doing a good job so far. But, you know, he's new on the job still, so it remains to be seen.
Well, we'll see how you cover him, because you're going to be now the executive editor at San Francisco Magazine, where you'll be able to read some of Gary Camilla's writings. And those of you who are looking for a book to buy for anyone this Christmas, if they love San Francisco, this is one you'll want to consider. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest has been Gary Camilla, and he is the author of that book, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco. I want to say thanks to our audience here at the club and to those of you listening on the radio. I'm Mark Hertzgard. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.